Hi, and welcome to the Ryle Books podcast. I'm really excited to be sharing with you the recording of an evening of readings with the extraordinary thinkers Rosie Stockton and Hannah Bayer that happened in our space in Brussels on the 7th of June 2025. Rosie and Hannah read from their recent work, after which I joined them in conversation and then we opened out for a Q&A with the audience. Both Rosie and Hannah are writers whose work engages rigorously with the poetics of desire and with how language acts as a site that both makes and unmakes relations. In different ways, their writing troubles the idea of a coherent, stable, or good subject. They approach gender and identity as sites of negotiation, opacity, and play, doing so with a rare mix of clarity, humor, and formal experimentation. Rosie Stockton is the author of two poetry books, Permanent Vaulter and, most recently, Fuel. Their poems are full of lyric loops, erotic tension, and a deep attention to the structures, both poetic and social, that threaten to both hold and break us. Hannah Bayer is the author of Trans Girl's Suicide Museum. She writes across genre and form, weaving memoir, criticism, and theory into a writing that is as intellectually cutting as it is emotionally generous. There is something in both of their work that feels like it emerges from a deeply personal space that's never fully private, a kind of intimacy that's always entangled with the social. Their writing makes room for contradiction, for not knowing, and for desire as its own kind of thinking. So at the end of the conversation, we open out to some questions from the audience, and we wanted to keep that as part of the recording, but bear with us as the audio quality of the audience is not always great. Before I hand over to the recording of the event, I just wanted to pass on my thanks to Maria Setnich, who initially connected us with Rosie and Hannah and also played a big part in making this event possible. So thank you, Maria. Enjoy the recording.
Hi, everyone. I'm reading from my phone tonight, which I don't like, so I apologize for that. And I'm also reading from a book that no one in the world has read yet. So you're the first people besides me and a couple of friends to hear about it. And the book is about parties, and this is a chapter about invitations. Sam, David and Ryan's ex-boyfriend, stood outside of an event at the Guggenheim Museum once. He was wearing a black Zara dress and a pashmina, like an intern, he told me, holding an iPad, which was actually a giant Rice Krispie treat, sheet pan-sized, though his conviction that it was a touchscreen tablet seemed to convince many in the line that formed. He firmly told people to wait in line, not by saying this directly, but by simply asking them if their name was on the list. Are you on the list? He would ask. The line formed. Some people became angry. Some were shy. Some lied. He was holding the boundary of this space completely unauthorized by the people throwing the party, yet inviting the people standing in line to negotiate with him. Recently, David, Sam's ex-boyfriend, was at a party at a stranger's apartment, and a drunk acquaintance pulled him aside and said, David, you and your friends are the type of people who would go to a party at someone's house and not even introduce yourself to the host, not even thank them. David laughed graciously and agreed and said, this is something I have done. And when he came to find me and told me this, I said, do you want me to introduce you to the host of this party? He's really nice. And David started laughing and was like, no. He's a gracious person, but he doesn't introduce himself to everyone in the room. In ancient Greece, the word xenia meant the particular morality between guests and hosts, an expectation which, like everything, probably is degraded in our time. Xenia was rooted in the understanding that anyone who came to your house could be a god in disguise. And so you should treat them justly because the way you treat them might have great consequence. But stories like this abound in all kinds of theologies and folktales. In Judaism, you offer a cup of wine and food to anyone who comes to your door during the holiday of Pesach because they might be the prophet Elijah. In the Dzogchen tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, there is a story about a wealthy man who becomes an ascetic. One day he is traveling and encounters a filthy woman who offers him a tray of fish guts. Despite decades of renouncing sensual and material indulgence, the downwardly mobile ascetic reflexively cringes. The woman then removes her disguise and reveals herself to be a Dakini, a deity of great power. She reprimands the ascetic for holding on to his wealthy upbringing, despite claiming to have renounced worldly things. He then goes to the banks of a river and eats fish guts for years, eventually attaining enlightenment. While these are morality tales per se, I recount them not to moralize so much as to illustrate that most traditions have some set of expectations around customs like these. There are, of course, mythologies and folktales with the opposite kind of message. The vampire famously cannot enter your house without first being invited. However, once the threshold is crossed, all bets are off. The tension between the deity in disguise versus the vampire presents part of the tension around invitation. If you exclude the wrong person, you may be doing something harmful, and yet if you include the wrong person, you also face a risk. To leave the realm of mythology and enter the practical, there are different ideas about what, in fact, it means to invite someone in, what, in fact, you are agreeing to. In the customs of Zenya, by accepting a guest, you are effectively agreeing to feed them, clothe them, wash them, offer them a place to stay and to rest for as long as they need. In pre-modern civilizations, before money could be used to stay in a franchise motel or purchase a meal virtually anywhere, these kinds of customs around bathing and nourishment and a place to rest were of great consequence for people materially. The customs have become kind of empty or missing in our time, in part because of a consumer culture where it's understood that people meet their own needs instead of having them provided by people they encounter in the world. So if you are constructing a space where you are having a party, the question for the convener becomes, what needs of others are you expecting to meet, and which ones will you decline, and how much of this needs to be conveyed in order to offer an invitation? I think often these limits aren't conveyed directly. Like, most people don't say, you can't sleep here, BTW, on a wedding invitation, but instead are like, lodging is nearby. There's an entire genre of comedy that just depicts people not getting these subtle cues. Because it's so, and the reason I think it's an effective genre of comedy is because it's so uncomfortable for us to watch someone overstay their welcome or act in a way at a gathering that's not appropriate to the gathering. Some of you are smiling in a way where it's like even bringing it to mind is like kind of amusing. And part of what is funny about it, I think, is that these limits are implicitly set and then someone just blows through them. And that's anxiety-inducing. I think part of why it's anxiety-inducing is because it's actually uncomfortable to have to say no directly after you've implicitly set a limit. And this is one of the questions that arise for someone who's containing a space, which is like, what do you do if a limit gets breached? How much will you bend what you've agreed to or anticipated in the face of an unplanned or socially inappropriate moment? One time there was a strange woman at a small party at Zach's house. There were maybe 20 of us, and we didn't know her, but she was warm and chatty and made her way around the room, joining different conversations. At the end of the night, everyone left, and she was still there. I'm going to bed, Zach told her, a polite way of asking her to depart. Suddenly, she seemed quite drunk. I don't know where I am, she said. You're downtown, he said. I need to get back to New Jersey, she told him. And they negotiated, and probably out of a mix of genuine concern and also a desire to get the person out of his house, he called her a car. And she went downstairs when the car arrived, and a few minutes later, he got a phone call from the driver and saying, you know, this person who just got into the car at a stoplight, she just opened the door and walked off. At his house that night, I think if one of his close friends had wanted to sleep over or be fed, he might have agreed to it. But this stranger maybe wasn't accorded that same level of permission. I was at an apartment recently at a birthday party in Brooklyn, and I had been invited by a friend who's also named Hannah. And I invited another friend, Horace. And then Hannah left, and the party was dwindling. And Horace and I realized we were huddled on these bar stools in a kitchen surrounded by people, maybe like 10 or 12 people who were like having an intimate experience, and we didn't know any of them. And suddenly I like hissed to Horace. I was like, go now. And he was like, oh yeah. And we like bolted out of the room right as someone was kind of coming over to be like, hey guys, what's going on? Other times I have stayed in awkward moments when it's clear I'm not connected to anyone. But for some reason that night, I didn't have the appetite for the courteous hostility I forecasted from the particular group that night with Horace. But finishing the night together is something that I think can be better achieved sometimes without a stranger in the room. I think what you believe about how much to offer people is a question endemic to groups. Whose responsibility is it if someone is hungry or tired or needs a place to sit? This is the kind of sharing dimension about the sense of what is on offer, really, between people when they're at a party, whether it's nourishment or libation or music or just some form of social attention. Parties are not always Edenic, and not everything is shared, not for everyone, and not to an unlimited extent. I have relished times when I have had parties and people stayed over, eaten food from my fridge, stayed on the floor, made do with whatever was available, sometimes not much. I prefer, I think, stylistically to over-offer and see what is taken up rather than to withhold. Often in collectives of hosts throwing a party, there is a dispute about invitation with the more inclusive position or the more aligned with the more maximalist position. This is not necessarily good or useful, but I just personally like it better. My painting teacher in college told me there were four cardinal rules in life, and one of them was know when to say yes and when to say no. And I just prefer to say yes, even if it's not a good idea. When I was younger, I believed that it was also virtuous to always say yes, that to set limits or turn people away demonstrated a lack of generosity, or worse, a kind of callousness. And as I've gotten older, I think I've come to see more of the usefulness in limits. Even if at times it can be painful for someone who is told no or disinvited or denied entry. There is an idea in the book of Exodus often told during the Passover Seder that Jews were strangers, or Hagar in Hebrew, in the land of Egypt, and so we should be generous to strangers, for we know what it is like to be in such a precarious position. Cf. the aforementioned prophet Elijah. And while I've come to see the virtue of setting limits or saying no, I am also living in a geopolitical moment where the no or the limit from the powerful towards the poor or the stateless is often marked by profound violence or cruelty. A nation state is not a party, and at the same time, a nation state that abducts and deports people to prison camps or black sites is a powerful statement about how to deal with the uninvited. It is tempting for me, at least, to use the horrors of exclusion at the geopolitical level to attempt to argue for a universal mandate of inclusion, which in reality may not always be appropriate or even effective for political aims. In attempting to overlay my love of parties with my wish for a just world, I can offer that limits or moments of disinvitation should be meted out with thoughtfulness and attentiveness to the experience of the stranger or the disinvited. In some social circles, and arguably in some societies, people are excluded simply to reinforce dynamics around superiority and inferiority, i.e. we know we belong because you don't. If you have to kick someone out of your party, do so without the framing the action as hinging on their inferiority and making sure they are generally okay. Like if you're kicking a drunk person out, make sure they know where they're going. The writer Isabella Hamad describes the moment of recognizing or humanizing the stranger, and how it can be a site of transformation, often in the arc of a tragedy, where the lack of prior recognition falls away and something new can be seen or understood. If you can recognize the stranger and treat them as though they are worthy of dignity, even if you need them to leave your house because you are going to bed, you can avert a certain kind of tragedy or at least needless harm. The question of what you are inviting people into is intimately linked to what you are offering them. The idea of Zenya is useful because it suggests an interlocking set of expectations between being invited and having something asked of you, such that guests and hosts alike are collaborating by bringing something of themselves. When someone appears who is outside this kind of reciprocal guest-host ethic, limits can be set. though I tend to believe that the potency of the offering is often demonstrated by feats of generosity rather than feats of boundary setting. I'll read a tiny bit more into the next section a little bit. This part is called The Feeling of Being the Stranger. One way I try to learn and relearn about being a stranger is that at least once a year I try to go to an immersive gathering where I don't know very many people and don't feel like I have a strong connection to the host or conveners. This is in part to hold on to the injunction from Exodus to know that you are always somewhere a stranger or a newcomer who might not feel authorized. I have gone to a lot of weird movement workshops and social justice retreats and dance parties in the forest just to have the feeling of not knowing anyone. I learn a lot from it. I had an experience of this recently when two of the supervisors at the psychoanalytic clinic where I work were throwing a Christmas party, and I felt extremely frightened to be invited because I work under them, but they invited me to their house for Christmas. It's not a clandestine party, but not everyone at work was invited. And I've been to their house before, but only for a reading group. One of my younger colleagues tells me really excitedly, we weren't all invited the day before. The limit, the boundary, the fact that it's only for some people makes it feel less like work and more like a party. Before I arrived, I am getting dressed and a thought crosses my mind. What if it gets late and I'm drunk? Will they let me sleep on their couch? Often this fantasy comes to mind for me to be invited to sleep over, to get to enter the space of the childhood party. My boss is there, the director of the therapy staff. She is severe and charismatic and tells me she used to smoke cigarettes when she lived in New York City, but she doesn't anymore. I am really nervous. There is another colleague of mine, a tall psychiatrist who makes edgy jokes. She told me a while back that one of my patients liked her on a dating app and then asked if it was a quote-unquote in the transference, as in, was my patient liking her on a dating app about the patient's feelings towards me? Everyone I work with talks like this. She rides a motorcycle and dresses like a lesbian, even though she used to be married to a cis guy. The motorcycle psychiatrist comes in from the back door and says, and I say, did you just smoke a cigarette? And she laughs and nods and asks me if I want one. We stand in the backyard, freezing fucking cold. I ask her to light my cigarette. Our hands touch as we cup the flame. It's windy and hard to light. You could do this yourself, she says, and then choosing an alternative without consulting me, takes the cigarette from my mouth, puts it in hers, lights it herself, then hands it back to me. I can't believe I got invited to this party. If you work in a psychoanalytic treatment setting, it is unusual to touch your coworkers. My analyst, who does not come to such parties, who I never see outside the consulting room, once described smoking cigarettes as having to do with, quote, orality, unquote, whatever that means. I go inside. Jeremy sits down on the couch and clears the coffee table. At a city party, he would be clearing the entire coffee table to cut lines or something, but I know this isn't what he's doing. I don't know what he is doing. He presents a wooden structure, a small house with a wheel of tea lights around the base. He lights each one, and as they generate warmth, the wheel of candles begins to spin slowly. I have never seen anything like this before. He teaches a seminar on, among other things, how to administer the Rorschach, in which we spend a lot of time reading aloud things people say in the blots, a monster, bears, dancing bats. This wooden house with the spinning wheel of candles around the base is like something from an ink blot. It's spectacular. I stay until I can't possibly stay any longer without being weird, helping clean up with the lesbian-coded motorcycle psychiatrist. Megan, my supervisor, who hosted the party, mentions in my supervision next week what she calls my quote-unquote quiet dependency, and I've never felt more seen. Part of what comes up for me when someone invites me to a party are questions in relation to a larger group of invitees. Who am I in relation to the broader community? Who else is going to be there? Another question that comes up for me is often, what is on offer? Can I stay? May I be of use in some way? Will they like me? Do I belong? How can I find a way to belong? If I have a problem, like my car won't start or I get sick, who can I ask for support? Thanks.
Thanks, Han. So good. So nice to see you all. Thanks, Chloe, and everyone else at Ryle for having us. You guys are, I don't know if you know this, but kind of legendary. as a bookstore. I've done like 4 or 5 readings now in London and Glasgow and Berlin, and everyone's like, "You're going to Ryle?" So we've arrived, the place to be. Okay, I'm going to read from my new book of poems that came out last month called Fuel. And actually, while Hannah was reading, it made me think of a poem I don't think I've read this out loud yet from this book, but it's a little bit about hosts and guests. So I'll start with that one. Let's see, where did it go? If I can find it, it's like in a deep, mysterious part of the book. Okay. Contact potential. Oh, host itch, all guest talk. Tend my ambient scope. Spare me operative, never fully included. But I like my spell doxing conduit, tell all at attention, proof of ill will. Oh, bother tote stain, oh, Luna bar crash hard. Waxing fuel plummet, when the chill falls, your tantrum fluffs the pillows, and I gift you a kill drive, your clock's lady in waiting game, unload a shouldn't or should I break here. Oh, dogged the glittering week that rends open time to fill with baggy dirt, to plant a start in the all day long. Skilled in always contending, oh, you're a townload, sacking my secret, man of twists and returns. So this book is organized into 6 sections, and at the end of each of the sections, there's a love letter addressed to the end. And this book is really haunted by endings of all different sorts. I was thinking a lot about the signifier apocalypse and the etymology of that, which means to reveal. And just thinking about the specter of the end or the revelation of something that love always sort of contains within it. So these are love letters to the end. Dear end, my fall for you is prelapsarian. Every time I leave our dream, I am under attack. It isn't my death they want, it is just to be inside. It is only under a new moon I learn to take you seriously. I leave my bed unmade, I show up late for work. We could be many things. I could give it up, I could tell you exactly what to do. Shut up or shut down, baby birding communion, transubstantiate your little joke. Let the tips of our boots touch, stack our books on top of one another. I memorize your schedule. Your metaphysics rule my circadian rhythms, my bowel movements. I have remained committed to our private bacchanal, left the cobwebs intact, so the breeze has something to touch. Chaotic in the absent moonlight. It softens me. It blurs my drive. You said keep going, and I kept going long after you looked away. Dispersal. Like a line that doesn't regulate, I edge commonly. Our verge retrieved the most daily feeling. Your orbit dragged me, picnicked in my altitude. Defining our joints, I explore abrupt logic to faster's limit, the supporting support where no law begins to say my wish I was. Consider a layer's flux expression. That's my wavelength, flaunting my freedom threshold. Tideline thinner, based enough to lift math to eliminate this halo fade. Too thin to support even any boundary. Our glow ignores the surface light, and sitting here with you, I thought, why not accept this hurdle, float a lifted constitution, place myself kindly in your slow gravity. Searing toxic, flooded sky, total absent undulation. Gathers the poured lot in state's genocidal parking fee where love's off gases blow out a tire with my digital memory and filthy fucking hands. That's the road all over me. That's the wallet flying off the roof. That's my everything lost twice the same way, but touch it, the pooling. How I spread out my everything between you, the dog, and the chemical foam hunting fish beckon to glance. A reddish horizon takes my breath up an atom. We are the only people today shrugging, stunning how the stolen Snake River confronts stone. Volcanic battery life surges, hungry snacks litter my lining. Strained for you, this is loving. I walk so fast, wanting water eddies to ghost, wanting to point myself out to you, there, there, and there. That poem's about getting in a fight with my partner when we had a flat tire on a road trip. So it's like so, when I read it, I'm like, it's so vivid to me. I wonder if you could see any of it. Anyway, I haven't read that one all that loud either. A colossal water turned me out, turned me ordinary. A violent authority rented my ruler, a verified directrix to play dead alongside as I track your soft swerve against my will. Our conduit's tantrum blocks me anonymous, flocking my ostrich trick. I bury this triangle deep in a rioting rhyme. Your thistle, our cement dust, and some filthy comet I feel. Again today, I'm waiting for your call. It's my giant secret that turns snow erotic, daring to thaw me, a deadlined employee, or any other gut word that disavows my private sphere. As usual, I hold your domino lightly, scaled up plop to make habit of your borrowed pace. A coming volta haunts my worn-out brake pads. Oh, cloud, I've never even shouted your name. If you had other limbs, I'd write them here. Could you eat even with unarmed inner life? But you really live like this, just cavity host, your grammar spilling everywhere. Now they are trading water futures, and I speculate the cost of my piss and wait for the price of gouged luxury air markets to freshen the space between my breath and your breathe, where there is all this subprime business. Oh, to be part of a no such thing feeling, a partial eviction, prefix menu of how loss is in me, a tier two user playing boxcar to be a grad of drowded alone. I save your plants in my recycled bathwater, souped up dirt dipping in my trade, me and your gym day, blowing our grip on any averaged catalyst. When I stroke the sky, it's to shuck dad's genre, to cast a shadow net, to bless the digested mollusk colony bent toward every singular pleasure. Velvet dirt, a then carcass technique of spinal cord rot and bloom, nothing but roots. Disordered scent, the most accurate preservation of chaos. Vulture spreading dives in the state shallows to bleed out cloud, a gnawed tomorrow is all over me, clocking the thinness of sails, the thickness of wind. You are on the couch with someone else's hell on your tongue. I'm longing for an argument to crack up our geotic unit and rock me into a glistening separateness that lets us in a little more. The problem with distance is that it just works too good. And when I understand it, I don't believe in it anymore. Contact potential. Yes, Gerund, curl up in my direct address. You need an allergy pill, and yes, I do too. You describe my private verbs, clatter locked in your joints, sniff and gash, shop and scatter my regiment. As our bind steeps in a weekly debt fall before a last-ditch Venmo request, you look at me like I'm good for it.
Yes, garden, you are here to be a perfect poem. Yes, scissors in your hair, cutting up time like you do, booked by the job search, unslept ribbons, marching mania to a classical rave. Yes, you never forget the bag, Pope shit, my holy committee. Yes, pit in my pit, I'm late, just like you like it. I wrote this one as a sestina, so it has the six words repeated at the end of each line. And then I you wouldn't recognize it as a sestina on the page, but you'll hear some of the repetition. At first, I had titled it Bad Mood Sestina, but I eventually took the titles of each of the poems out and just left them with bracketed space. But I still think this one is a bad mood sestina. Villainous spaghetti, you couldn't be farther from my station. A stain on my void, I glance the dry cleaner's offer. Reluctantly, I blot with tide pooling tide pen. What's the difference between work from home and staycation? I only work for pleasure. I taste each sip's praise. As career careens, we evict the mansions, detoxing prefabbed design. The pouring rain governs our station. I duck any oncoming praise, gather my drives to jam the margin, any bender to bring you closer to my design. Lyric and bursting, this body's my offer. It reeks of praise. Infecting flame, alive in the margin, I take up your station, decay like a mansion. See how I'm doing on time? Okay. Dear End. In this dream, I couldn't hear anything you were saying, but I knew you were saying something. I woke up laughing. I am jealous how you can just subtract yourself like that. I tried to expand time as not to feel it. I want total comorbidity with you. Now, I edge myself because I don't trust you. You want to know how your absence is affecting me? In the dream, I couldn't keep my clothes off. Every time I rolled over, they were back on. You treat me like a crushed out trick, like some utopian simp. Let's be practical. Let's move money together. We will master laziness. We will reproduce ourselves exquisitely, take loss after loss, and lose nothing. Decked out now, you're raining down my asphalt, infected, possessed. This is how I play our game. So come on up. You must want entirely or not at all. Pump Jack. And a note on the form of this poem is that the lyric lines are interwoven with found text from this book called The Story of Oil, which is published in the early 20th century about the history of the petroleum industry. So it goes from describing like literally how ancient fossils are turned into oil in the earth, and then progresses to describe like the mechanisms of early pump jacks and oil rigs, all the way up to the kind of like turn to the modern petroleum industry in the early 20th century. Pump Jack. All my lies, they stick to layers of dead sea creatures, leather, thunder, voluptuous. Solidifying on the seabed, wrapped in proximity to another skin, buried under sedimentary rock, a brief stranger asking for an origin under all that weight of stone, story, and spilling cash dreams. Not even oxygen can penetrate like ardent release, unallowable otherwise, that deep, coaxed, provoking calmness. I take off his metaphor, trapped and becoming belt, the paranoid distraction of mud and plankton and silt, extraction or guilt or pain, and sand salted weight of spewing messages. Water pressed thinner and written in lipstick, I stimulate his partially decomposed layers, most compacted memory, under heat of something hotter than my lips, dragging this way over the sun's downward pressure, finding tectonic cracks to slide through, hips landing on air or so near death, beds of shale and earth's radiant ardor, condensing tones to be seen and even more viscous, protected and engulfed, a plush fantasy marked by impermeable rock and contained by the storm lessons of geologic time. Pump Jack. I've got thighs. Fracturing, they exhale like methane drains in the castle infrastructure, a process all vice and bricked, time porous with injected water, to desire bundled up earthquake carbonation, sand and forbidden threshold, against the sentence wells peering in the window from a geotime portal. The resulting fractures in my mind, Central Valley oil fields surround shale rock, glisten thick, formulations allow ancient public footpaths for hydrocarbons to escape to the gentle oikos and armchairs, a mixture of water, Roman fascism, American pop culture, needing sand and chemicals to understand itself, and poetry pumped into the feed at high pressures, as clouds burn off like untranslatable stories. They move through the imperceptible holes, tune my attention, a worker's catastrophe in the casing toward global big box stores and fluids that crack open state-abandoned options. Narrowed down to the shale rock and we clean our shit together. The sand holds target. The welcome portal keeps forgetting us. And there are chemicals I forget how to pronounce, tuning the air and pumping out a totality I can't parse, out proceeds thousands of cubic feet. We feel it. That's how we know it each day. I'll read one more. Pump Jack. The rock is permeable, most rock, except when it's pushed to the limit. Erosion trips the sundial to an amount only the law can measure, as if the future could be accounted for with numbers that stay on their side of the bed. Even though I was older, I always thought you were. I looked to you for answers like, what if there is beauty and you aren't there to receive it? Define heaping just before it begins to hurt. If I evaluate you within a degree of perfection, could that prove my love? So I began to claw at paving stones. Stardust slams are present. Velocity. Take the city apart. Velocity. You are good at controlling the pace at which the horizon arrives. You are willing to walk away, which makes you closer to me than I am. When you clock my compulsion, it's in the palm of your hand, like a busted lock. The phone is ringing. Velocity. Despair makes a hero out of me, so I get busy, fly around an untangled sun, upend myself, donate my organs to the poets. Earth creaks blatantly, asking for help. My hands crumbling, sprinting on surfaces, velocity. Once you lap me, I can finally let you. Thanks.
Yeah, wow. Thank you both so much. It's really a pleasure to have you here reading. I feel like it's so... Yeah, both of the way that you use writing to think through a very kind of present moment in a contemporary feels like it's really like a gift. Like I'm always like, there's something that feels very new as I'm listening to you, and that's rare and exciting. So thank you. I wanted to start with a very open question, knowing that you also just came from Amsterdam from the Summer School of Psychoanalysis, that I wondered if you could both talk a little bit about your relation to psychoanalysis and how that is or isn't a framework for how you approach writing, and if it brings anything in relation to form or if it's a way of thinking through situation.
You want me to go first?
No, I think I can do it. Thank you for that question. Yeah, and I meant to say thank you for the introduction as well. I guess I have been reading psychoanalytic theory for many years. I'm really interested in it, and I've also been in psychoanalysis myself for the past 5 years. And something I'm really interested in is repetition, and I think that's something that, you know, in a clinical analytic experience, you are forced to traverse your own deadening repetition over and over and over again to basically try to understand or feel the logic of the repetitions. And then, you know, maybe the closest thing to, you know, what we could call a cure in psychoanalysis is like finding a new repetition or finding a new symptom. And I think about that a lot in relation to poetic form, where at least for me in writing this book, there's a lot of signifiers that are repeated, and I very intentionally do that to find like what can happen as I repeat a signifier, not only in the same poem, but throughout the whole book or throughout sections in the book. And it's partially conscious, right? But partially when I'm reading the book out loud, which I have been doing repetitively, I'll be like, oh my God, I've used this word like 14 times. And it's kind of, it would be like a random word. And I'd be like, why is this signifier showing up in every single poem? And so even in the process of reading it out loud, it's like I get to traverse my own repetition and try to think about my relationship to whatever that is. So I think, yeah, that is, maybe I'll think of something else to say, but I'll pass it to you for now.
It's interesting. I feel like watching Rosie get into psychoanalysis over the years has also been helpful for me to relax my own like anxiety about it as a discipline. I work now at an analytic institute where I'm also in training, but I offended my colleagues recently when I said, well, my interest in working here is actually just that all the patients live here and know each other and all know us. And that's extremely unusual in a clinical setting. And that's the main thing I'm interested in. It's not analysis. And they were like, fuck you. Like, we care about this thing. And I was being slightly irreverent, but I think I felt sort of seduced by it over the years as a way of thinking, partly because it feels like a form of philosophical inquiry that's has a interpersonal methodology. And I think that's actually quite rare. I think a lot of philosophy like only lives in the mind. And I think it's very beautiful that there's this kind of form of philosophy that has not just questions about the individual and dyads and groups, but actually has like practices for engaging that. And I find this to be quite beautiful. And I think also as I've done the work more, both as an analyst and as a clinician now, I also am starting to believe that it works. Which is like very, it's like painful work. So it's like to start to believe in it is also like a defeating experience, because it's like, you know, starting to believe that you have to keep going and repeating and suffering and failing, which is like, you know, not a great, it doesn't really sell itself. But I feel like on the threshold of having a kind of devotional relationship to it in this part of my life that I think like, a few years ago, I might have been like, oh, no, not for me. So it's interesting. I feel like I'm in a kind of flashpoint with it in my life, yeah.
Mm. And it's interesting that, yeah, there's something of it really as a practice that like really that gets translated into form in a way in both of your work. I was also wondering, which is maybe has a relation then to thinking through psychoanalysis, is how both of you work with either the affect or the concept of ambivalence, which is maybe a big question, but it comes, I think, for both of you in slightly different ways. But I was reading an essay that you wrote, Hannah, on therapy. It's called Therapy Has Never Been Secular, and it's like an amazing essay. I really recommend everyone to read it. And in it, you talk about you're in school and you and your classmates are like really anxious around therapy exams that you're taking, and then like your teacher says like gives you a speech and is like, oh, you need to build your tolerance toward ambivalence. And I thought this was such an interesting story that you like told inside of this article. And then I was like, oh, but I feel like that's also what you have done in your writing or something. That I was like, this is also, that's something that I find very exciting, is that I think you really hold on to scenes of ambivalence in your cultural critique that is very precious, that you don't try to like resolve or to close a situation, but you stay really proximate with these spaces of ambivalence. And I find that really exciting. And then I wanted to ask you about, Rosie, about your the way you use line breaks, because they're some of my favorite line breaks in your poems. And I was like, I think this has a relation to the question of ambivalence. And this, like, yeah, the moment of kind of like affect or turning or holding multiple things at once.
There was a workshop at the summer school in Amsterdam about feelings moving in between people and whether you can kind of interpret this. Like, if you're having a feeling, did it come into you through someone else? And someone, one of the students in the audience, asked this really beautiful question, which is like, if you work in that way, if you start to interpret your own feelings as coming from someone else, like, are you in danger of like telling other people what they feel, or, you know, being authoritarian in some way, or maybe just being like a kind of an asshole? And I think it's that question is so beautiful, and it's a really, I think, illustrates why I think ambivalence is so important politically, because I think that certainty often leads to violence. And so I think that if we, not to say that like violence can never be used for political ends, but I think even especially maybe when using violence, having some understanding, some ambivalence about it, and some understanding of what can't be controlled or can't be known about effects, and also in general with one's strong convictions to hold them with, yeah, some contingency, has helped me so much in my own thinking and my own ability to tolerate contradictory experiences, both in clinical settings, but also like in activist spaces, and also in like my deepest relationships. I think it's a very like, it's a very moving idea, and it's also very uncomfortable, hence the idea of tolerance for it.
Yeah, that's great. I love this question. And I think a lot about, building up tolerance for discomfort and ambivalence. And I guess to respond specifically to your formal kind of provocation is, I mean, I have a very indulgent relationship to line breaks, I think. And sometimes, I there was a line in the book, in one of the poems that I cut, that said, I enjam, like break the line, enjam, I enjam when I'm feeling needy. And I think there's some truth to that, where there's like, okay, I'm having an affective feeling of like the unbearability of not being able to say two things at once, which is usually what I want to say. And I think proper syntax and grammar is actually quite painful for me. Like, I don't know how you're writing a fiction book, or not a nonfiction book, with like full sentences, because I'm like, I need every line. The line break allows you to end the sentence and continue the sentence at the same time. Like, you get the cut. So you force your reader to like live with that signifier at the end of the line, but then you get to keep, but then it keeps going. And I feel like that kind of formal element of the poem is something I use a lot to like to build my tolerance for ambivalence and like bring that into relation with the reader. And I also agree with Hannah that capacity to tolerate ambivalence or discomfort or uncertainty does have really high political stakes. And I think there's a lot in this book that I was grappling with about kind of like one's own maybe like capacity, or one's own maybe like impulse to defend myself, to defend oneself, particularly in the face of one's own potential to harm another person. And I think there's a lot of ambivalence around that when we're like thinking about harm in our relationships at our parties, asking people to leave or not, right? Like, how do you negotiate both being like a guest and a stranger, and holding that in your own subjectivity, and kind of like always like moving back and forth in that ambivalence. And I mean, I personally like have been super drawn to psychoanalytic frameworks for helping think about how one expresses that, how that comes out in one's symptoms, in one's relationships that repeat over time. And then, you know, trying to have more, see it a bit more clearly, you know, and have a like little glimmers of freedom of one's own, how one repeats one's own strategy for coping with that type of discomfort.
I'm having like two associations from what you said. One is the writer Hannah Black said this thing to me once where she was like, oh, this person I've kind of been seeing is really upset with me. And I was like, what's going on? And she was like, well, you know, I told them I'm feeling ambivalent about the relationship and they got so offended. And I didn't know how to explain to them that ambivalence is yes and no. It's not just no, it's yes and no. And they couldn't hear the yes at all. They were like, ambivalence means no. And she was like, no, no, ambivalence means yes. So I think there's something like in the question of like, how do you tolerate it? Part of it is also like hearing the yes in the ambivalence, like holding on to the yes, even with the no. And maybe related, like loosely riffing off of that, the thing about line breaks. I have this problem even when I try to write poetry where I'm so like orally dependent and so greedy that I just can't let the line end. Like I want endless lines and I write these giant block poems because I like can't break it. It's like too, I'm like, no, no, it has to keep going. The sentence has to keep going. The thought has to keep going. The like, the nourishment has to continue streaming or something. And it might actually be really helpful for me to try to enjam my lines. So I'm going to think more about that.
Wow. There was another interview I read of you talking about making noise music, Hannah. And you say also in the interview that like you, in order to be able to perform, it was like your first noise concert. And in order to be able to perform, you were like, I can't stop. Like it just has to continue, like from the moment that I start playing. And this feels like the same strategy of something of like a kind of like ongoingness that also permits something to like pass through. And then it's like material and maybe then there's a way to. But it's interesting. I hear like an echo of this scene. Does anyone have any questions that they would like to ask or thoughts or would like to share? And I mean, it goes for the two of you also, if you want to ask each other.
My question is a little bit to you, Hannah, but it strikes me that you're very interested in space in your work. Like in the passage you read, it seems striking to me that you're interested not simply in the party as an event, but as a kind of threshold between inside, outside, invited, uninvited. I'm also thinking of your description of Trans Girls Suicide Museum, of course, as like a very physical space with rooms, and you describe like a swing. Or I think I heard a reading where you talk about like moving into a new apartment and like your ear infection. So I'm wondering, I guess, how you think of space, if you think of it at all, how it relates to your larger interest in the interpersonal, maybe.
Actually really crazy that you asked that question because I've been trying to write about this because it occurred to me recently. Like, I don't think I knew that I had there was a specific thread in my own thinking about physical spaces until like 2 weeks ago. And I was like, what's up with this? And so and I've been thinking about it a little bit. So I have a little bit of something to say about it, but you also might have a better idea about it than I do. There's this research for like assessing what are called like adverse childhood experiences or ACEs, and it's a quantifiable score you can add up. You ask like, did the person have like a parent who was incarcerated? Did the person have like a parent who died? Did the person experience this kind of trauma, etc.? And one of the things that adds to your ACEs score is actually moving. So if someone moved once, it puts their ACEs score up a little bit, their adverse childhood experiences. And if they moved a lot, it puts it way up, actually. And I was thinking about that question, being like, why would moving be, like, why would this happen? And I did move as a kid a couple of times, so it's not like outside of the realm of my own experience, but there's something kind of intuitive for me about why do you need a home? Why do you have a relationship to space? And there's something I think maybe related to like my parents and grandparents being refugees, where I'm kind of like, oh, like maybe it's not intuitive to me that like a physical space would mean something besides a power structure that you might get kicked out of, rather than like something that you're attached to and that holds you or contains you. So this is like a little bit of the edge of my thinking around it, but it's, I've been having this recurring daydream of just thinking about interiors and being like, oh, this is so bourgeois. It's so like cringe. It's so like, oh yeah, you're like in your mid thirties. Like you just want to think about interiors and trying to ask, like, is there something I'm thinking about that's not just like, because I use social media and like see interiors all the time that I keep on like thinking about them in passing. And I think that's like a tiny part of the edge of the thinking on that question, but it's very, very thoughtful. Touched that you asked that.
Thank you.
Can I maybe extend that question onto you, Rosie, to maybe talk about the residency you were in when you were editing Fuel? Because that was also like,
yeah,
like in relation to in relation to place somehow in space.
Yeah, yeah. I wrote this book while I was living, I still am living in Los Angeles, and I had a residency at the Bonaventure Hotel at this studio called Apogee Graphics. And the Bonaventure Hotel is, if you've read Frederick Jameson's essay, like kind of like canonical essay on postmodernism, there's a couple paragraphs about this hotel as like a kind of the prototypical postmodern hotel. And it's basically like, it was built with this very like utopian vision in mind. And there's crazy water features. There's five different towers with glass elevators. It was kind of built so you could live there almost. And like there's stores, there's restaurants, there's, you know, the hotel rooms now. But one of the things about it is it's extremely difficult to navigate around. You like completely get lost. You'll be like, okay, just need to go to the fifth floor, like suite A. And it's basically impossible to find. And so, and I actually host a reading series there now. And all of my friends are like, this is so annoying. Like we cannot find our way to the reading. And I'm like, no, this is, you need to lean into that frustration. Like I want you to actually have to feel that on your way. Like you're having a postmodern experience. So anyway, this is where I was, when I was editing this book. And actually it is where I decided to take all the titles off of the poems that were originally written as like in singular entities with their little umbrellas, with their titles. And I wonder inside, it's like very like self-analysis. Like I wonder if there is something about the disorientation that I was when I was going to this hotel every day, and like I figured out how to get to the place, like where I needed to go without getting lost. But like if I had to go to a different place in a hotel, I would definitely like have to like go up and down and around, and it would be very difficult. And I think maybe there is something fruitful in the flicker of annoyance or fear or frustration of getting lost, and the taking out of the titles of the poems and kind of letting them bleed into each other a little bit more, and not exist as concretely separate from each other, or kind of like making the boundary between the poems a little bit more hazy. I think this question about place too, and this is something I wanted to ask you when you were reading, is to talk more, think more about, Xenia, is that what it's called? Xenia, the kind of hospitality and this like, or even like the list and the question of threshold is really interesting. Because I'm thinking a lot about place in this book, but also like when I think about threshold and limit, it's really time. It's like when a relationship has to come to an end or change, and that it's like I'm really grappling with like loss and fear as time is like moving forward. And I think you're thinking about this belonging or non-belonging, like the threshold is really spatial. Maybe we don't need to be so binary, like I'm time and you're space, but I'm curious if you can talk more about the threshold or the limit.
I love the idea that one of us is time and one of us is space. That's extremely cool. Yeah, it's interesting thinking about like the threshold or the limit at the end. And in some ways, I think part of what the piece that I read is about is almost like the threshold or the limit at the beginning. Like, what do you actually need in place to get started? I think there's a lot of like kind of cringe writing about like things that aren't political borders being borders, or things which aren't literally prisons being prisons. And I think the reason I say it's cringe is because it's like crass in a way to compare experiences that are like not those things to those things when they're so violent. But at the same time, I think there's a kind of a tendency in my own thinking to want to invoke those ideas because they so underscore the basic nature of the reality we live in a country like this or a country like the US where I live, where the kind of basic premise of reality is based on the border and based on who's allowed in and who's not allowed in. And so I think those ideas, you know, in every subsystem at the level of the family, at the level of the neighborhood, at the level of like the town and the state are all like at the level of the nightclub or in people's minds in some way, consciously or unconsciously. And I think it's part of it is about trying to negotiate that. For me, that's part of where it comes from in me, this kind of fascination with it being like, is it okay to, if we don't want borders in general, is it okay to have a border around like who you want to spend time with or something? Like if we don't want to have like carceral systems, can you kick someone out of your party if you don't like them interpersonally? You know, like these kinds of questions I think are not the same exactly as political questions, but they trail me around in an obsessive way. So I kind of think about them.
Are there any more questions?
I have a question for you, Rosie, about kind of related to your talk that you gave earlier this week, which I won't attempt to summarize because I won't do it well. But there was this particular thread around like the bearable and the unbearable and how that relates to your poetics, and also related to Lacan. And I just had this question listening to you where I was like wondering if you had an experience of the unbearable becoming more bearable through writing, and if so, what that was like, and if not, also what that was like.
Oh yeah, that's a really good question. I'm going to give like the quickest summary of the talk because I don't, while I think about the answer. the talk I gave was based, like the question I was asking is if in the like psychoanalytic concept that what we demand from our beloveds, they actually can't give to us, and that we are always going to be kind of like coming up against this border of insatiability. Like, wait, why can't I feel totally safe? Why can't you give me all of you? Why can't you complete me? You know, haunted by the idea of the soulmate or something, like you find your love and then you're going to be okay. Like, why hasn't the other done this for me? And then how to kind of ask for love and also then respond when other people ask us for love, in ways that help us bear the pain of, you know, having to remain incomplete with another person, and always kind of like having to confront the lack that will always repeat and haunt the relationship, any relation, but even like the one's relationship with oneself. And I don't know, through writing, I don't think writing makes things more bearable. I think that there's this Alice Notley quote that was going around when people were posting a lot after she passed a couple weeks ago, that someone was like, you know, does writing help you suffer less? And she just was like, no. Definitely not, you know. And I feel similarly, like I think writing does maybe help me understand some of the suffering that I'm going through, but I've never really felt like understanding the pain is what helps me bear the pain. I think there's other practices I do in my life that help me. Maybe it's one of the things that helps me bear the pain, but I also really am interested in like how we can help each other bear each other's absence or something like that, or like collaboration on sharing the load of the lack that exists in our relationships. And that happened. I mean, language is so pleasurable for me. So I think I do get a lot of pleasure through writing the poems, or like if I'm in an extremely painful interpersonal moment, like, yes, I'll journal. Yes, I'll write a poem, or like the poem can actually be like a container for some of that pain, but that doesn't mean the pain has like neutralized, or that I've like gone to the spiritual gym and like gotten stronger in terms of withstanding it. What about you? What do you think writing helps you bear more of the unbearable?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I think it helps me like digest it intellectually for sure. And sometimes thinking helps me moves me from one place to another. I think that's also something that, like, it's like helpful about psychoanalysis that I've like grudgingly accepted as being like, oh, when your thinking changes, sometimes you feel like you moved. But I don't know if that always comes or necessarily has anything to do with the level of unbearability. I think sometimes it can stave it off, but I don't know if it actually reduces it. Yeah. And like, I think the thing you said about pleasure resonates with me a lot, that there's something also about trying to use words to be in unpleasant or really painful experiences that can be pleasurable, and that also that just then rides along what's unbearable, and that can be kind of like interesting and can add something of a sweetness to it. Yeah.
I wonder, extending that like unbearability beyond, like, knowing that you're both writing in the context of America now with Trump and all of the really terrifying things that he's doing at a very fast, like, how this unbearability, the scale of it is something quite difficult to comprehend in many ways. And I wonder how, yeah, maybe less if writing or if poetry and literature helps make things more bearable for you, but like, do you have any thoughts on like what poetry and literature, like what place that has in relation to a historical moment such as this in the States, specifically in relation to like the kind of lives that are being censored? And yeah,
I mean, it's interesting because I think I'm a little skeptical about it. Like, I think that there's a lot that writing and literature can do for individuals and their experience. And I think there's can be things that can be mobilized to do for groups. The idea of people gathering around the death of a poet to talk about what that person's work meant to them is incredibly beautiful. But I think a lot of the kinds of like ways of working at our relating to this moment in history, which is so much about, in the US, is so much about hyper-individualism and like having an individuated set of rights that then permit you or don't permit you to be safe. I think a lot of the meaningful interventions will come from collectivity. And there's something that I think at times feels kind of luxurious to me about working at the level of the individual, both in my own consciousness, in the analytic setting, in writing. And it's something I really appreciate about getting to read or be with groups in public in this way, is that it is a little more like it moves the dial a little bit more towards like away from the individual and towards the group. But I do think that the group will be the way that we meaningfully intervene on what is happening geopolitically in this time.
Yeah, thanks for that question. Juliana Spahr has a really good answer to this, which I'm just going to copy right now. Where in her new book, she basically is tracing her own kind of like poetic. Juliana Spahr is a poet from the Bay Area who was part of Running Commune Editions and is like, you know, participated in like leftist action for a very long time and thinks a lot about the relationship between like organizing and poetry. And she wrote this recent book that was about her kind of like poetics, her kind of like, you know, Ars Poetica as the political climate changed over the past three decades and what she was doing in her life with her comrades. And she was like, I think poetry is actually a very bad call to action, even though I think people really try to use poetry to be like, we, you know, like, this is the staging grounds for where we can like organize people. And she's like, I actually think it doesn't do that very well, but maybe it occupies this space between like the grief that is part, the grief or anger, the affect of like the kind of like helplessness one faces in as an individual trying to like comprehend one's agency in relation to these things or like build power. The space between like the grief of that feeling and then the call to action, that poetry can like occupy that, not necessarily to initiate anything. And it's great if it does, but it can like kind of vibrate there and maybe help us like comprehend what's going on. And I think like something else I would say that is useful for me in the poem is maybe like my own poetry doesn't make me feel better, but other people's does, actually. Like Alice Motley's makes me feel like that. That makes life feel more bearable. And so I still have a bit of a romantic relation that's like, I don't want to say kind of like apolitical romance to aesthetics, but I'm like, yeah, I'm like, you know, it makes me feel, I think, you know, the poems that make me feel like I can bear things are those which draw me into collectivity or like remind me that I'm not an individual, and then like have some sort of sense that, you know, any despair of isolation is actually like a fantasy that this, you know, political reality wants you to feel, and that that can actually be burst through. And poems in particular, I think, hold scales of intimacy and like geopolitical violence like very closely without having to explain it very much. And I think even just that proximity in the poem of like clashing scales, like in this book, I'm putting questions around, you know, the petroleum industry and what the oil extraction going on in Southern California, you know, right next door to where I live, alongside like the end of a relationship and like, otherwise, you know, just like being like, okay, in the poem, I can put these two scales of exhaustion and despair next to each other. And there's something like revelatory about that for me.
Thank you for taking on the question. I think we have time for one more question if there is in the room or a thought. Okay, we can also allow it to happen spontaneously with a drink afterwards. Thank you both so much for your generosity in being here and reading and sharing your work and just for your work in general. We have books on the front table there, and there's not a huge amount of copies, so I would recommend buying one as soon as you can. And thank you all for coming this evening. Thanks for listening to the Ryle Books podcast. This episode was edited by Roz Del Olmo, and the music was composed by Eve. If you liked this episode, please think about subscribing to our channel. You can also find more of our past and upcoming events, as well as browse our collection of books via our website, www.ryle.space.